Mr. Wicks.
I am Rory Wicks. I am here on behalf of the appellants, Keep the North Shore Country and Sierra Club Hawaii Chapter. May I reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal? I'm also here with my co-counsel, Marco Gonzalez of Coast Law Group, and Bill Hunt and Laura Couch of the Alston Hunt, Floyd and Ng firm. May it please this honorable court. Keep the North Shore Country and Sierra Club Hawaii Chapter are community and environmental groups. They have members who reside throughout the North Shore communities. These members have serious concerns that the expanded resort at the Turtle Bay Kualima Resort will impact their lives, their communities, and the North Shore environment that exists today. These impacts have never been studied in a document prepared under the Hawaiian Environmental Policy Act, Chapter 343, known as HEPA. These impacts should be studied. In this case, because the impacts have not been studied, we request respectfully that you reverse the Circuit Court judgment, that you reverse with directions to the Circuit Court to grant North Shore and Sierra Club's motion for summary judgment. We ask that you do this for three reasons. Times have changed on the North Shore. There are new circumstances, a new environment in which this expanded resort will operate. The second reason is HEPA policies and procedures. When there are new circumstances or evidence, HEPA should impose an obligation on all agencies to go through a procedure, a process, a relatively simple process that should not be too time-consuming. That agency should take a hard look and should make an independent determination whether indeed the factual setting of a project has changed, whether there will be different or likely increased environmental impacts.
Council, does the passage of time in and of itself require a supplemental EIS?
No. The passage of time, if it results in a change in the circumstances of a project, the factual setting of a project, and if that operation of that project in the new factual setting will cause a new kind of impact, a different kind of impact, or a likely increased impact, then the two of those combined triggers the duty under HEPA and under the Environmental Council's EIS rules to prepare a supplemental environmental impact statement.
What if circumstances surrounding the project change, but the changes were foreseeable when the EIS was done? Does that require a supplemental?
That, of course, did not occur in this case, Mr. Judge Foley. That would have been anticipated in the original document, the original environmental impact statement. That would have been obligated under HEPA. That, of course, did not happen here.
Is traffic congestion foreseeable?
It wasn't at the time that the EIS was prepared. The EIS was very clear. The sole access road, Kamehameha Highway, I'll refer to it as Cam Highway, did have some congestion. It did have some temporary slowdowns, but they did not predict the kind of conditions that now exist on the North Shore. In fact, that EIS predicted that this expanded resort would have minimal impact.
It's pretty much true around the island, though, isn't it? I mean, isn't that pretty much true around the island? I mean, we have traffic congestion that people certainly didn't predict or plan for.
Yes, it did. The real unique part of this case is the delay. For some reason, the owners of this resort chose to delay implementing their project for more than 20 years. Their EIS was approved in 1985. The current resort owner did not even apply for their approval of their subdivision map until 20 years later.
But if the city has currently updated traffic studies, correct?
There are representations there are updated traffic studies.
And the city can, why does the city need to do a supplemental impact statement on traffic or with respect to traffic if they have updated traffic studies that can inform their decision making?
Because of the core fundamental reason for HEPA. There are two reasons. One is public participation. The Supreme Court recently in the Sierra Club versus Department of Transportation case talked at great length about that fundamental purpose of HEPA, that its essence is to promote public participation. In this case, the public has been excluded from this process to whether or not to grant this discretionary land use approval, this preliminary subdivision. The second reason is informed decision making. The HEPA statute imposes requirements on all agencies to take extra steps so that they have sufficient information to evaluate the environmental risks of a project and to balance those risks about the benefit of the project.
But under the HEPA, the statute seems pretty clear that a developer has to basically create a master plan and apply and do the EIS that covers the anticipated project. And in light of the unilateral agreement, it does seem like they were, Coahuila was required to build, address some of the traffic infrastructure issues, and a lot of conditions were imposed on them as a condition to them getting the subdivision approvals. So what's the status? I mean, what's the impact of the unilateral agreement on the fact that the developer was required to undertake these a huge investment on their part in order to get the development approved?
Both the EIS and the unilateral agreement were prepared in 1985, 1986. That's 22 years ago now. They only anticipated the conditions that existed at that time. Once again, we do have times have changed. There is this new environment on the North Shore. There is this traffic gridlock that was never predicted at the time.
Interesting. In terms of information, in other words, say the city undertook to decide whether or not changes in traffic had an impact. Wouldn't they typically rely upon traffic studies being submitted by the developer?
Yes.
All right. So how would requiring an SEIS as to traffic differ in terms of the information available to the city from the city looking at traffic studies that are currently available to them?
HEPA procedures and process. They're designed to promote public participation and have informed decision making.
Sure, but in this case, substantively, what additional or different information would the city have been looking at in deciding how to change things with respect to traffic than it already has?
We never got to that point. Had the HEPA process been followed, they would have had to go through a process where, yes, we have taken a hard look, we've looked at the situation, we have done an environmental assessment, we may have to do an SEIS, a Supplemental Environmental Impact Statement. That would have then gone out in a 30-day notice under the Environmental Council's rules. The public would then have had an opportunity to participate, to comment on what that study should have been. The public would then have been involved in the process. Then the supplemental EIS would then have been prepared. We would have had the entire comment period. And the public would have had an opportunity to present their own evidence.
But in the litigation that followed in this case that leads up to this appeal, did the plaintiffs provide traffic studies that differed from the studies that were available to the city, or show that the studies that the city had, updated traffic studies the city had, were somehow invalid or inaccurate or inappropriate?
Two of the North Shore directors submitted letters to the city. One of those letters was submitted in April 2006 by Mr. Gil Riviera. That letter went into great detail discussing the traffic studies that had been generated since the project was approved in 1985. He referenced the 1991 traffic studies, the 2005 traffic studies, and several government reports that showed that the traffic conditions had changed. There had been a change in times. In this case, it didn't matter. And that is one of the most troubling aspects of this case, in that the agency, the City and County of Honolulu's Department of Permitting and Planning, took the position that any change in circumstances is irrelevant. They put their head in the sand. They put the blinders on.
Isn't that result required by the statute, though? I mean, the statute says that an EIS that's accepted with respect to a particular action shall satisfy the requirements of this chapter, and no other statement for the proposed action shall be required. And the action has not changed.
There's two responses to that. The first is that statute refers to an environmental impact statement. That does not mean that only one environmental impact statement shall be prepared for a project and nothing else can be required. A supplemental statement can still be required for the project. And I completely...
Where do you get that from, though? I mean, where does it say that in the statute?
You add in the definition of what statement is in the HEPA statute. That's at Hawaii Revised Statutes, Section 343-2. They define statement to mean environmental impact statement, and then they describe what that is. That addresses the broad range of areas that an environmental impact statement is supposed to address. A supplemental statement is a different creature. It doesn't address the broad range. It addresses only those areas in which there's been a new circumstances or where the impacts will be increased. It is a really focused on only the areas, and in this case, it should be focused on traffic and protected species.
The purpose of a supplemental environment impact statement, like an EIS, is to inform decision-making by the city. What discretionary decisions are left for the city to make that would be informed by an SEIS? Or are we, as the developer argues, so far down the approval process that there's nothing to inform in terms of decision making because the city is already committed to permitting the development as already approved?
The city has not committed to allowing the project to go forward. Back in 1985, when the EIS was approved, the city expressly informed the owner of the resort that it would still have to obtain a series of discretionary land use approvals before they could implement the project. That is actually the letter in which the city and county accepted the project. It's found in the record. It's dated October 30, 1985, and it outright states that several land use approvals will be required in order to implement the proposed project. These are listed in Part 11 of the EIS.
Have they been approved already, though? Have
no.
Those been obtained
no.
yet? Which have not been obtained?
Subdivision approval. That is the seventh item listed in that Part 11, page 190 of the Environmental Impact Statement. And this may well be the last final discretionary land use approval, wherein the City and County of Honolulu does have the obligation to evaluate whether there has been either a change in the project, a change in the circumstances in which the project will be operated, or there's been a different or likely increased environmental impact.
So isn't the difference between your clients and the city and the developer, they look at the statutory regulatory scheme and say, if there's no change or significant change in the project or the proposed action, no supplemental EIS is required. And it's your position, reading the same statutes and regulatory scheme, if there's a change in the circumstances surrounding the project, then a supplemental EIS is required. Isn't that the difference here?
That is correct, and their interpretation is clearly wrong. They are looking at the language of the Environmental Council's rule, which deals with general conditions, Section 26. It, in essence, says that any action that has been approved with respect to a particular project is usually qualified by certain characteristics. They are size, scope, location, intensity, use, and timing, among other things. They then argue that language means that only refers to a project, that if there is no change in a project, then there can be no requirement for a supplemental EIS. That rule never uses the term project. It uses the term action. And action refers to the project, but it also refers to the second half What is the effect of the project on the environment? What is the intensity of the environmental impact?
But your position, proposed action, is a broader term than project.
Absolutely.
It includes all the circumstances of which the developer would have no direct control.
How do you get to that conclusion when the definition of action under HEPA is any program or project to be initiated by any agency or applicant?
I look at the simple and plain meaning of the language contained in both sections 26. Section 26 describes these characteristics, and five of them clearly apply to a project: size, scope, location, use, and timing. The fifth one, intensity. Intensity, that term is used in the very next rule, Section 27, Determination of Applicability. It is used in the term of intensity of environmental impacts. It states outright that a supplemental statement shall be warranted when the intensity of environmental impacts will be increased. The Environmental Council clearly intended by that language that this term project isn't limited to just the project, but to the first part, project, and to the second part, the intensity of environmental impacts, which means...
Wait, are you saying action in the regulations means something different than action in the statute?
It clearly does. It clearly does, and that's the clear intent of the language. Why would the Environmental Council use the term intensity of environmental impacts if that wasn't something to be considered? But what this means is, yes, indeed, if there is a substantive project change, it is one of these triggers which would require supplemental environmental review. But it also means, the second part, that if the intensity of environmental impacts are increased, or if because of new circumstances or evidence, it shows that there's likely to result a different kind of environmental impact or an increased environmental impact, that also requires the preparation of a supplemental environmental impact statement. And that is exactly what has occurred because of the resort owner's 20-year delay in going ahead with their project.
But specifically in terms of the subdivision approval, what can the city do to alter or change the project? In other words, as a condition for subdivision approval, can they say you can't build 3,500 units, you can only build 3,000 units or 2,500? Or, well, what substantive changes can they make as part of the subdivision approval process?
They can do a lot. And if you look at the subdivision ordinance and the subdivision rules and regulations, one of the things that the DPP and the director is supposed to do is to grant subdivisions in order to preserve, enhance, and promote the environment of the community. It also goes on to say that they should also grant subdivisions in order to prevent congestion. These are what they are required to do in imposing conditions on a project. I don't have an answer for you whether that is the appropriate decision. That is not my job. And really, under HEPA, it's not this court's job. This is a statute which deals with procedures and information. Okay. We are here just to compel the agency to go through the process so that the public participates and they do make their decisions in an informed manner. We're not here to evaluate the merits of their decision. That's not what this statute is about.
You referred to Section 26 of the Department of Health Rules, 11226. But the last sentence says, as long as there is no change in a proposed action resulting in individual or cumulative impacts not originally disclosed, the statement associated with that action shall be deemed to comply with this chapter. And so I guess what we're trying to figure out is what individual or cumulative impacts were not originally disclosed in the original EIS, because it was pretty intensive.
Traffic and protected species. The traffic conditions are far different now than they were in 1985. There's conditions of gridlock at certain times, Saturdays, holidays, periods of high surf.
That's anecdotal, though, right? I mean, now you have H3 that allows you to get that way. You've got the bypass, so you've added additional bypasses to that area.
These conditions exist from the Haleiwa bypass. up to the resort to Kahuku. It helped, the bypass, of course, helped traffic coming out of Old Haleiwa Town. But it hasn't ameliorated the problem. That, of course, is the first change in cumulative impacts, the first where the intensity of environmental impacts have been increased. The second is protected species. Threatened species, green sea turtles, endangered species, the Hawaiian monk seal. They now use the beaches within the resort. They didn't. There was no reported sightings of them from 1985 until 2001. Yes?
One clarification. Did you state earlier that the regulations define action differently than the statute?
The Environmental Council rules do define action as any program or project initiated by an applicant or agency.
But if there's a difference in the definition of action, wouldn't we have to defer to the statute, which is a higher law?
There is, the intent of the legislature in enacting HEPA was not to address the entire gamut of what HEPA should apply to. The statute, section 343-6, clearly gave the power to this environmental council, this neutral body, 15 people appointed by the governor from a broad range of interest. That is their job. In fact, in the recent Supreme Court opinion, Sierra Club versus Department of Transportation, they went at great lengths to describe that environmental council was given that power.
You're not saying a regulation can redefine a term that's defined in a statute.
It is addressing the statute, and it is addressing something that, of course, wasn't directly addressed in the HEPA statute itself. The HEPA statute is eight provisions. There, of course, is no direct statement in that statute for supplemental environmental review. Not a surprise. It was, of course, based on federal law, the NEPA statute. The U.S. Congress did the same thing, the exact same thing.
Well, you find, then, the definition of action in the statute troublesome because you have to bring in all the surrounding language of the...
I would not use the word troublesome.
No.
I would use the word explains, that clearly the Environmental Council intended that the effects of a project is a factor that the agency is supposed to consider in determining whether supplemental environmental review. And that is clearly contained in both the sections 26 and section 27. Section 26 also actually states that if there is a change in any of these characteristics, a change in the intensity of environmental impacts, then a supplemental statement shall be prepared. That is all we are asking for. The next statute, Rule 27, outright says that a supplemental statement shall be warranted in two situations that are relevant here. When the intensity of environmental impacts will be increased, or where new circumstances or evidence bring to light different or increased environmental impacts that weren't dealt with before. That
one of the concerns raised by the city in Kuilima is that the actual letters of request for the supplemental impact statement were pretty sparse in terms of supporting information. So in terms of line drawing, what's to prevent the public from inundating the city with letters at each stage of the process saying, well, gee, now I think you ought to require a supplemental impact statement because I have concerns about traffic or I have concerns about changes in the environment. Where do you draw the line? Otherwise, wouldn't the city continually be sort of boxed up having to address whether a supplemental impact statement is required at every step of the way? How do we draw a line as to when's appropriate and when's not?
Well, there's two responses. One is, yes, a government agency could be inundated, but that is what was promised to the people when the statute was enacted, that they would have an opportunity to participate in this process. The second answer is, in this case, the agency gave no forum to provide comments. The HEPA statute itself, section 343-7C, requires that a party is aggrieved if it does submit in written comments during the designated review period.
But your position is that when they receive such a request, they're obligated to take a hard look. So you're saying every time they get a request, they have to sort of stop and go, okay, we need to take a hard look at this moment as to whether a supplemental impact statement is required. And then they get another letter 3 months later, they got to stop and take a hard look. Is that the process, or am I missing something?
That is not the process. The obligation to take a hard look arises only at certain defined parts during the land use approval process. When, in this case, an applicant, the resort owner, requests a discretionary, non-ministerial land use approval. That is exactly what was done at this stage. It is at that stage that the City and County of Honolulu must take the hard look. And it's clear that at this process, this is that discretionary stage. We've talked in our briefs about how this underlying ordinance refers to it as an approval, that the director's decision can only be set aside for an abuse of discretion. But beyond that, one of the main functions of the subdivision ordinance is to impose conditions on a project to further, let's say, conservation of the environment to prevent congestion. How can it be a ministerial, a non-judgmental act to require the planning department director to impose conditions? Those can never be. Those conditions must be tailored to the project. That is a discretionary land use approval. And in this case, yes?
The Sierra Club brought an action against the Office of State Planning in the, Coal Ridge case, and you wanted an environmental assessment done before any kind of reclassification of land was done. So it seems like a developer has to develop a crystal ball and figure out exactly what is going to happen to this piece of property before even going to the Land Use Commission?
Only in the unique facts of this case does that arise. This is an incredibly unique case. It probably won't arise. This project is giant, 5 hotels and over 800 acres. It's a dinosaur. The resort owner chose to not apply for this subdivision permit until 20 years after the EIS was approved.
But let me understand. At the time that the EIS was prepared, I mean, Kahuku Sugar Plantation had gone out of business. The area was economically depressed. And so as part of the approval process, the city required that they provide jobs, that they develop a wastewater treatment plant. I mean, there were a lot of conditions that they had to meet before they could even come in for the subdivision approval. So how do you... are you saying that we're going to have to provide compensation to the developer if now the subdivision, which is one of the last steps of this whole development plan, is not approved?
Absolutely not. This, is, of course, is not a vested rights case, and really this is a HEPA case. So really vested rights don't apply.
Well, isn't it a vested
rights case? How can a resort owner declare they have a vested right to go ahead with their project when 23 years ago, when their EIS was approved, the city outright told them they will not be able to implement this project unless they seek further discretionary land use approvals, including the subdivision process. There is no vested right to go ahead with this project. They have to go through these other processes, and in this case, the resort owner brought it on themselves. In most cases, that's one of the uniqueness of this case. In no other case I've ever seen, these processes go fairly quickly. There would have never been this third unique factor, this change in the circumstances, this new factual setting for the project, so that the project that was envisioned in 1985 will cause a different kind of impact to species, an increased impact to traffic congestion. This is a unique case. If you order the resort owner to prepare a supplemental EIS statement in this case, it is not going to apply to almost all the cases you're ever going to see. This case is so unique. It won't apply to the normal process where a small subdivision, somebody wants to subdivide land, perhaps to give it to their children. That family is going to go through that process fairly rapidly. there's not going to be a 20-year delay. There will be no change in the circumstances or evidence in which that project will be done. This unique facts, this unique situation won't come up in those cases. So if the concern is that by ordering a supplemental EIS in this case, we're really going to harm the people of Hawaii, it won't happen.
Is this court to order a supplemental EIS or to remand it to have the Department of Planning and Permitting take a hard look?
The former. We ask that you remand with directions to grant North Shore and Sierra Club's motion for summary judgment.
But your position is that the DPP did not take a hard look.
Absolutely.
And isn't the agency the one who's supposed to, in the first instance, make the discretionary decision as to whether an SEIS is required?
Okay. Yes, the problem here is, and that's the most troubling aspect of this case, DPP doesn't consider new circumstances or evidence. The testimony was clear. We consider those things irrelevant. DPP, in this case, put its head in the sand. It put blinders on. It looked only at this interpretation. Is there a substantive change in the project? If not, we don't go any further. That, of course, reads out of the Environmental Council's rules this language about new circumstances or evidence.
But if they're wrong in the interpretation of regulations and we tell them what's right, why shouldn't we go back and tell them, look at it under the right regulations, under the correct interpretation of the regulations?
It's easier to be an advocate than a judge. I'm glad I'm not on your side of the bench. But clearly, the underlying facts, the hard facts of this case establish that if they did a minimal hard look, they would clearly conclude that there are these new circumstances, that there is this increased intensity of environmental impacts.
So for the remedy that you're requesting, we would have to find, as a matter of law, given the information that's presented in the litigation, that no reasonable agency could have refused to order a supplemental environmental impact statement.
We have proven that as a matter of law. Absolutely. There are these new circumstances. There are these changes.
Could you address Kualima's argument that the subdivision approval is a ministerial act?
Yes. It is not a ministerial act. I've already touched upon that. The statute itself gives discretion to the DPP director to deny or grant those decisions. The statute itself and the subdivision rules and regulations refer to it as an approval. That was the analysis used by the Supreme Court in that Sierra Club versus Hawaii Office of Planning. You look to the underlying statute. If it refers to it as an approval, then it's a discretionary approval. But beyond that, and of course it also says that if your subdivision application is denied, you can appeal to the zoning board. But the zoning board can set it aside only if you show an abuse of discretion. That clearly shows the director has discretion in this case. And once again, how can the imposition of conditions be a ministerial act? It is a case-by-case judgment call, an exercise of free judgment and will by the planning director. What is appropriate for this individual project? No one could just say the statutes require this, we're going to impose these kinds of conditions. No. That director must exercise discretion. This is clearly a discretionary land use approval. One of the real problems I have with the resort owner and city's arguments is that they claim that really there are no discretionary land use approvals after the 1985 EIS was prepared. That, of course, is not correct. Both the city informed them of this fact, and it doesn't anticipate, I mean, they don't have a right to go ahead and subdivide. They do not have a right to go ahead and build the project just because of approval of an environmental impact statement. And certainly, if they choose to delay implementing the project for more than 20 years, they bear the risks that perhaps times have changed. They bear the risks that they may have to do supplemental environmental review. This is an incredibly unique case.
Are subdivision approvals one of those approvals where if the agency doesn't act on time, it's automatically deemed approved?
Yes, I believe it is. That's why we have very competent people in the Department of Planning and Permitting. They take their job seriously. But in this case, they have a defective practice. They will not follow the, what I suggest to you is the clear mandate of the legislature and the Environmental Council, that in certain situations, they must look at these changes in conditions, these new circumstances. For you, the city and the resort owner are really taking the position that those words in the Environmental Council rules should be read out. They should not be. We have, of course, also suggested this court look at the guidance from other jurisdictions, and they do provide some guidance, primarily the NEPA statute. We are asking for the same obligations of an agency under HEPA that has been required under NEPA for 30 years.
It's slightly different, right? It only applies to actions by the federal government or funded by the federal government, whereas we apply it also to private citizens that are applying for agency approval.
That's correct. Although a federal NEPA project could involve private participation, and it would apply to that.
Are there any state lands involved in any of this project? I mean,
no.
Any tunneling that needs to be done under state highways or?
Well, there is improvements required under this project for state highways. It's one of the conditions of the project. The resort owner is required to do improvements to the portions of the state highway in front of the project. That alone should be one of these triggers, one of the nine enumerated triggers, which requires that that this project be subject to HEPA. Under the arguments you've received from the resort owner and the city in this case, there should have never been an EIS on this project at all. They claim that there is no trigger. There's no shoreline setback. There's no use of state highways. The city clearly concluded at the outset of the project that this project is subject to the HEPA process. This project remains subject to the HEPA process.
Are you using the term project to just mean this latest subdivision approval or the entire development project?
Okay. The project is the expansion of the Kualima Resort. A component of the project is really not the subdivision, but it's what we have here is a further discretionary land use approval, which they must go through. They must go through these hoops in order to build their project. There's the project itself. Okay, there's been a change in the timing of the project, clearly. If you don't implement a project within 20 years, under any scenario, that is a change in the project. But the important point here is, because of that change, that there is these exact circumstances that the Environmental Council anticipated. That is, we go back to the Environmental Council rule, that Rule 26. If there is a change in any of these characteristics, then a supplemental statement shall be prepared. There is a change. There's clearly a change in the intensity of environmental impacts to both, and what we've talked about here, to traffic and to species. My time is up, but I do urge you. The statute is about public participation and informed decision making. That has not occurred here. The public, whatever decisions were made from our perspective, was done behind closed doors. The public has a right to participate in this process. And the public has a right to know that, in this case, the Department of Planning and Permitting has made an informed decision. And the record is clear before you that they have not. They have not considered these substantive changes in the environmental setting of the project. I am back for rebuttal. Thank you very much.
May it please the court. My name is Don Kitaoka. I'm a deputy corporation counsel for the city and county of Honolulu. With me today is Lori Sunakota, also a deputy corporation counsel. I'm here before you, your honors, in an attempt to preserve the process, in an attempt to preserve the orderly process of land use approvals. And I got 10 minutes to do that. But in my 10 minutes, I just want to get an overview of what the Kualima developers went through under the scrutiny of both city and state agencies. First, they had to go through a land use reclassification at LUC, which looked at the state plan, looks at the standards of the reclassification of lands, and applies those and has a public hearing and forwards it on at that point. After the land use reclassification, it goes through a zone change. A zone change is a city approval. It considers the general plan of the city. It considers the development plans of the city, in this case, the sustainable communities plans. And this is where the EIS process comes into play, because the Supreme Court has always stated that the EIS process must be done at the earliest practicable time. And in fact, the Supreme Court said that time should have been at the LUC level, or the state reclassification level. In those days, 1986 or so, it was thought that the EIS process would kick in further on in the process. The city approvals that were necessary in this matter were a zone change, a special management area permit, and a shoreline setback variance. Those are discretionary permits. Those are discretionary decisions by the city. And this is where an EIS was done. There's no contest. There's no dispute in this case. The action is the development. The action is the Kualima Resort development.
Is a subdivision approval a discretionary determination by the city? I noticed that the plaintiffs made a point that the city didn't join in Kualima's motion below for summary judgment on that issue.
That's because so that
what
is
what's the city's position on that issue?
That's a very complex issue, and that's why the city didn't want to get into that dispute. Subdivision approval is basically ministerial. When I say basically ministerial, there is an approval process by which subdivisions will have to ensure adequate infrastructure, access, roadways, electrical, water, and all those kinds of utilities. And if the city is assured of that, the city is supposed to grant a subdivision approval.
What about in this case? Say, for example, updated traffic studies show that traffic is really bad in that area. Could the city require, as a condition for subdivision approval, that roads be rerouted in the development so to alleviate potential traffic concerns?
The subdivision process first starts out with a review of construction plan review. And construction plan review is an interagency where the subdivision sends it out to all of the pertinent agencies, including the Department of Transportation. If, in fact, tentative subdivision approval is granted, there is a final subdivision approval, which is granted at a later stage, on the condition that all of the concerns that were brought up, say, by the Department of Transportation were satisfied.
So in answer to my question, is that something that could be done? In other words, if in as part of the approval process, information came to light that indicated a traffic problem, could conditions be imposed on the approval that required changes in roads or other things that would address that concern?
Absolutely. And in fact, it not only could be done, but it has been done and continues to be done, because as far as what a hard look is required by DPP, a hard look is inherent in the process. A hard look is inherent in the approval process for the subdivision. That subdivision application comes in. That application is routed to every pertinent agency that DPP figures has a stake in the matter, and then comments are given to the DPP in order for that subdivision to be approved.
Well, are the facts that the agencies are looking at the facts that exist at that time, or are they projecting into the future?
They're looking at current conditions, and in fact, if in fact DOT or even the city's Department of Transportation Services has a concern about traffic, it would be requesting that the developer update his traffic report so that it has current information. All information that is in fact assessed by DPP in the subdivision approval will be current current information that is required of the developer and required by the DOT or the DTS.
The plaintiffs are saying that if you look at current conditions, then when the conditions change 20 years from now, it's not fair to rely on that particular planning process, approval process, and bind the neighborhood, I guess, to those original plans. So how
The current conditions will be assessed at the time of the approval that is being sought. So if subdivision is being sought now, the agency review would send out for comments, what are your requirements given the current situation of traffic? And so DOT could say, well, given the current situation, we require this left turn lane here. We require this kind of infrastructure to accommodate the current conditions. Everything is current, including the monitoring of the UA conditions, the unilateral agreement conditions, the monitoring of the conditions contained in the special management area permit and the shoreline setback variance. All of those conditions are continuously monitored by the DPP so that...
Now you indicated that there was, it's a difficult issue as to whether it's a discretionary decision or not. But in the context of this case, what's the city's position as to whether the subdivision approval in this case is a discretionary decision of the city?
In the context of this case, it is ministerial with respect to the kinds of approvals that the subdivision division needs to make. The reason that I waffled a bit and the reason why the city doesn't want to get into this determination is because there are considerations of public health and safety which are inherent within the subdivision rules and regulations, and which the department would look at satisfying concerns of public health and safety in approving subdivision.
Does that require the exercise of independent judgment as to whether something does or does not qualify as satisfying public safety?
That's where it gets a little iffy as to whether it's discretionary or ministerial, because when there is a consideration of public health and safety, the DPP may determine that, say, an access road coming in from one highway is safer than an access road coming in from another. And so that's why, I mean, I'm not going there for whether, in fact, subdivision approval is discretionary or ministerial. For purposes of HEPA, the whole emphasis that I want to make before this court is that this went through the gamut of approvals from a very public process in the zone change, very public process in the shoreline setback variance and the SMA. It goes from extremely discretionary approvals and it funnels down to more specific. So you go through LUC, you go through zone change, you go through special management area permits, then you go through subdivision. All of these land use approvals are going from the most discretionary to the least discretionary until you get to grading permits and building permits, which are completely ministerial.
Now, with respect to the regulations themselves, I understand from the city's argument is that step one under the city's interpretation of the regulation, the first step is whether substantive changes to the project itself had been made. And if no substantive changes had been made, the city has no authority to authorize or require a supplemental impact statement. Is that correct?
That's correct with respect to the plain meaning of HAR.
All right. Now, is that the process that the DPP employees who are charged with the decision as to whether to require a supplemental impact statement, is that how they interpreted the regulations?
It, in fact, interpreted regulations to abide by the HAR to determine whether there has been a substantive change in the process that would make the project an essentially different project, so that a new supplement...
Their determination, based upon their looking at the plans that had been approved versus a subdivision application, was that there had been no substantive change in the project.
Yes, it's not only that, but even with the consideration of every single comment that is coming in from all of the agencies when it's going through a subdivision agency review.
All right, but given that mindset, is it fair to say that the city people who decided not to require a supplemental impact statement did not consider the plaintiff's position, which is that there may have been circumstances surrounding the project that may have had a significant environmental impact. They didn't consider whether those surrounding circumstances themselves would require a supplemental impact statement.
Well, those surrounding circumstances are inherently always considered in the process. Now, whether that in fact triggers a supplemental EIS.
Did the city employees go through that thought process in making the decision as to whether or not to require a supplemental impact statement?
They continuously go through the process of determining whether there has been a change in the project. For instance, if an agency...
Not a change in the project. Change in the circumstances surrounding the project that are independent of any substantive change in the project.
Okay. Those considerations are considered within the process. Not within the HEPA process, but within the subdivision process.
How do we know from the record whether or not the city employees actually did that in this case? I mean, is there something in the record that said, well, the city's position is that we only look at substantive changes in the project, and we find no substantive changes, so we deny the supplemental impact? Is there anything in the record that said, well, even though it differs from our interpretation of the regulations, we also looked at whether changes surrounding the project would have resulted in a substantial environmental impact? Did they do step number two or not?
The record is filled with the process, as far as the description of the process of what, in fact, the city has to go through and actually went through in analyzing the approvals for the Kuilima project.
Now, so let me ask it this way, just as a matter of law.
By the way, I need to reserve time for my...
We'll be flexible with time as we were with the appellant, but isn't it your position that if there is no significant change in the project, but there are changes in the environment surrounding the project, no supplemental environment impact statement is required?
That is the position of the city in a nutshell, given the plain meaning and the language of HAR.
The circumstances surrounding the project change, so the impact of the project is different than at the time it was approved. No supplemental EIS is required.
Right. No supplemental EIS is required, but I will assure this court that all of those factors are being considered constantly within the DPP's process.
But not in the context of whether a supplemental impact statement is required.
Not in that context. In the context that current conditions are always assessed in the approval process, and that even goes through the completely ministerial processes of DPP, that in fact current conditions would have to satisfy it. The project will have to satisfy current codes, for instance. The project will have to have input from agencies based on today's conditions. So there's no question that the process works. If, in fact, we take the plaintiff's view in this case, this would be a case where you can bring the orderly land use approval process to a screeching halt. You can paralyze agency determinations because it would be in a perpetual state of limbo if the process is always required to begin again every time new information is available.
Let's suppose a developer got approval, initial approval, and the EIS was prepared for a development with, let's say, 500 moderate income houses. And then down the road, they decide they want to switch it to maybe 200 upscale homes. Will a supplemental EIS have to be prepared at that point?
Well, I would say that they wouldn't be able to change it unless there is a change in the discretionary permit conditions that require the moderate income homes. Or if the moderate income homes, in fact, is being changed to 200 luxury units, that's a change in a project. And when
basically
there's a change in a project, then we're gonna look at the trigger for the supplemental EIS. If a different project comes in, then I will concede to your honors that a supplemental EIS is required because the project has changed. So the whole analysis is, and in all fairness to the land use, orderly land use development, it has to be assessed at the earliest practicable time for these environmental factors to be considered in decision-making, because in the beginning of the process, those decisions are discretionary, and those decisions are taking into account public testimony. The record is replete with references to how public this process was for these approvals, and the record is replete with the kinds of conditions that were attached to these discretionary approvals. But when you go down the pipeline, and in fact, we go from the broad general planning guidelines of the general plan and development plan, and we narrow it down to specific code requirements in the subdivision ordinance and the subdivision rules and regulations, we're going from discretionary to ministerial. And we can't be having every time, and that's why I was so impressed with this court's questions when it came to, well, you can't have a reassessment every time a letter comes in. You can't have a supplemental EIS every time a letter comes in. It would just basically render decision-making intractable. And it would provide a gridlock for orderly land use approvals if that is the reading of the statutes and the rules.
Is it too late for the city to make substantive changes to the project based upon current conditions?
It always requires conformance with the current conditions in the subdivision process. The subdivision process will make sure that adequate infrastructure is provided for this project, because the agency comments are coming in, and the agency comments include comments from the DTS, Department of Transportation Services, and the DOT. And in fact,
the agency comments is traffic is so bad that we can't sustain 4,000 more units. Can the city say, okay, the condition of the subdivision approval is you scale it down to 3,000 units?
If in fact DOT comes in and says that it can't, that the project cannot be accommodated on its highways, then there will be no subdivision approval until the DOT says that it can. So those kinds of questions and those kinds of concerns are always assessed.
So your position is that because as part of the approval process, the city considers current conditions, there's no need for an SEIS, supplemental impact statement?
Well, the first point is that there has to be a substantive change in the process, because that's the way the EIS statutory scheme fits into this whole scheme of land use approvals. It fits in at the beginning, and if in fact the project has changed to the extent where it needs to kick in again because there have been changes to the project to the point that the project is not the original one, it's a new one, it's a different project because of these changes, then we kick it into the start of this process again, and we kick it into the EIS analysis. And that is where the city would require a supplemental EIS if, in fact, that's not the same project that was presented when we went through all of these discretionary approvals which had a public input at the time. That's not the same project. So you need to do a supplemental EIS. And there's no question about that. So all I'm saying is that when in fact, a letter comes in or a concern comes in, those are not the kind of things that you say, this is a supplemental EIS, go ahead and assess it. Those kinds of things are always considered and become part of the DPP's file in determining whether the approval before it should be granted.
Is it standard for the city to require a unilateral agreement and declaration for conditional zoning before a development is approved?
Oh, it's not only, it's standard in any zone change that the zone change has to, the project proposed in the zone change will have to be assure the city that it would in fact satisfy all of the city's requirements and whatever is necessary for that zone change to be compatible with the project and the city's concerns are all addressed. A unilateral agreement is required for such zone changes where it's project driven.
Why is it called a unilateral agreement?
Well, that's anomaly. It's like I'm agreeing with myself, right? It's an anomaly because it's actually a declaration for conditional zoning, saying that I agree to do all of these things if I get my zoning. That's a whole nother issue that I don't think that we want to get into as far as the
So when you said that the City Department of Planning and Permitting monitors compliance with this unilateral agreement, I mean, like, is there a time?
Oh, yes, it's annual. It's supposed to be annual in that they require periodic reports that, in fact, all of the conditions of the unilateral agreement are that the developer is in compliance, and developer has to show that to DPP. And in fact, because a zone change is approved by the City Council, that report goes to the City Council for review, just to determine that the developer is constantly in compliance with those conditions. And those conditions also require, like, the satisfaction of other agencies to make sure that the developer is in compliance with the recommendations of the other agencies, say the DPP or the State Historic Preservation Division or other divisions like that. I mean, if you go through the conditions of the unilateral agreement, you will find that that project is undergoing constant city monitoring to determine that it is in compliance with the conditions that were imposed upon the project. With that, I'm going to turn it over to the resort.
Hello, I'm Sharon Lovejoy. I'm counsel for Kalima Resort Company, and I'm here with some of my colleagues, Lane Hornfeck, Will Yamamoto, and Shyla Cocknett. As an initial matter, the lower court considered several motions, four of them, in combination. Five motions, one included the plaintiff's motion for summary judgment. One included Kalima Resort Company's motion for summary judgment based on the burden of proof or the merits. And she ruled on those two motions, granting Kalima's motion and denying the plaintiff's motion. There were three other motions being considered at the same time in which the judge decided, based on her ruling, those motions were moot. One was for summary judgment based on statute of limitations. One was for summary judgment based on the status of the subdivision process. And one was for summary judgment based on no private right of action. Included in the summary judgment relative to the merits, although not a direct claim, there was an issue relating to whether the HARs here are ultra vires of the statutes. And I go there here because of the questions that that have been posed earlier. Hawaii's HEPA statute has section 343-5G, which says once a statement has been accepted, no other statement shall be required. That provision is not in NEPA. It is not in the federal counterpart. And the appellants have argued that a supplemental environmental impact statement is different than an environmental impact statement, but I direct your attention to the definition of a supplemental environmental impact statement in 11200-2, which says that a supplemental environmental impact statement means an additional environmental impact statement. And I'm going to go ahead and read the rest of that because I think it also bears on the interpretation of the statute very heavily. I'm sorry, the regulations very heavily. A supplemental impact statement means an additional environmental impact statement prepared for an action for which a statement was previously accepted, but which has since changed substantively in size, scope, intensity, use, location, or timing, among other things. That's the entirety of the definition of a supplemental impact statement. And so I don't think that any reading that considers that definition, any reading of the administrative rules could take the last sentence of 11200-27 as a standalone requirement for a supplemental impact statement. Also, that interpretation would also require that the many provisions of 11200-26 and 27 that references that there must be a change in the project be ignored.
But looking at the policy behind HEPA, I mean, doesn't that support the plaintiff's view that, in other words, the purpose of the environmental impact statement is to provide informed decision-making to the agency?
Yes.
Now, if the project, say you get the environmental impact statement at the beginning, if the project changes, doesn't it stand to reason that for informed decision-making, you need to be apprised of the environmental impacts of those changes?
Well,
under your interpretation, once the EIS was there, even if the project changed, you couldn't require a supplement.
Oh no. Well, if
under the statute, because you say the statute does not contemplate a supplemental impact statement, just an original impact statement.
Two issues there. One is, if there is a supplemental environmental impact statement, that's just a standalone requirement of consideration of cumulative impacts irrespective of a change in the process, then absolutely it would not be permitted under 343-5G. So what happens is the only way you could read the HARs together with that prohibition in 343-5G is to say that the change in the action has to be so substantial that it's essentially a new and different action under consideration. And that is the language in 11200-26 that makes it work. They're saying, okay, we recognize, can't have a new one, but if it's such a change, it's so substantial, it's essentially a new and different action under consideration.
Right.
And that's how it can work.
Under your interpretation of the regs, then if, as long as there's no substantive change in the project, the city was prohibited from requiring a supplemental impact statement.
Yes.
Okay. We'll give an extreme example. Say the project itself hasn't changed, but there's a hurricane on the North Shore that wipes everything out. Your interpretation of the regulations would mean that even though the circumstances surrounding the project itself had changed drastically, that there would be no ability of the city to require a supplemental impact statement to assess the changes in the impact on the environment that were attributable to the surrounding circumstance change.
I would say correct under these rules in the environmental impact statement process. But as Mr. Kitioka said, they would be looking at all of those circumstances as they continue to look at all of those circumstances, but it would be in the process, the development process as it goes forward.
So the public participation aspect of HEPA would not apply to my hypothetical situation because the city would not have to include the public if the circumstances surrounding the project changed, but the project itself didn't change.
Under our rules as they're written, that's right.
Does that make sense in terms of a rational interpretation of the regulations? I mean, substantively, what's the difference between a change in the project and a change in the environment that's so drastic that it's really conceptually a different action being undertaken?
Well, luckily, that's not what we have in this case. And so even if that were a valid consideration, it's not what we have here. But I would draw back that might be a topic for discussion. I know that the rules are being looked at now to be relooked at. And under NEPA and many of the state equivalents, it is written very specifically differently than HEPA statute. It does not require the change in the project resulting in a significant new environmental impacts not previously considered.
Why does that decision make sense? I mean, if the end result is that there are going to be different environmental impacts from the project, why does it matter whether those different environmental impacts result from a change in the project versus change in the surrounding circumstances?
The reason it matters is because we have a process and we have individual parties, not governmental entities here, investing huge amounts of money into a development process, and if these considerations were not taken into account as part of the process, then we'd have something different. But here it is an effort to slow down a project in order to consider what has been brought up as significant environmental changes, when in fact the North Shore has changed less than anything else on this island. And so in order to take their account that you have to consider everything regionally every time there's an alleged change and redo it, the process would get totally bogged down. And we'd be back into the EIS process every time somebody alleges a change. Well, like, here's what we have.
If you're correct, and the city took a hard look at the changed circumstances, they wouldn't necessarily have to order a supplemental impact if they, after taking a hard look, determined that things really hadn't substantively changed such that there's no need for a supplemental impact statement.
I agree with that.
All right. So it's not that every time someone makes a request, the city has to order a supplemental impact. They have to exercise their discretion as to whether a supplemental impact statement is required.
Yes.
But your position is that under the regs, as long as the project hasn't changed, they don't even have to make that consideration. In other words, they don't have to even assess the effects of the changes in the surrounding community or circumstances as long as the project doesn't change.
As our rules are written, that's what they say. Our rules say that. And the changes in the surrounding community, such as other developments that have come online, et cetera, should be taken into account what's already been permitted and titled. And so some of those considerations get taken into account not only in this development process, but in the development process and consideration for other projects. But what we have here is a situation where we're at subdivision approval. We have certain things, and I'm going to this issue because of the questions earlier posed. Our position is subdivision approval is a ministerial action. And although there is some discretion relative to conditions, what our administrative rules require, they define what is an approval, what is discretionary, what is not discretionary. And it talks about discretionary consents. And the subdivision rules, when you look at them, allows, as long as somebody's following the laws and regulations in submitting their subdivision application and supporting papers, the DPP can grant with conditions or they can grant without conditions, but they don't have the discretion not to grant it, like you do with the earlier stages of the entitlement, the earlier stages that Mr. Kitaoka took through. So we argue that the level of discretion in imposing conditions for the subdivision does not make it discretionary, and certainly for the purposes here.
Correct, as Mr. Kitaoka stated, that in deciding whether to approve a subdivision or impose conditions, for example, the city could consider traffic concerns, such that if a current updated study said traffic on the North Shore is horrible, they could either perhaps condition the approval of the subdivision application on improvements to the roads, or they could reroute roads within the subdivision to try to alleviate traffic concerns on Kamehameha Highway. I mean, could they do all those things?
Yes, and in fact, they do those things.
Wouldn't that be an exercise of independent judgment that information about traffic would serve to inform the decision maker?
Yes, that's true. My point is, though, that as long as they comply with those conditions, as long as they comply with the laws and regulations, there's not discretion to just deny it, like there would be in other levels of land review.
What about Helen's comment, if your subdivision's disapproved in some form and you appeal it, and the standard of review is abuse of discretion?
Yes, and I do agree that there is some level of discretion, but I don't think that looking to the standard of review when we have a definition here in our administrative rules is the best way to look at it. I think we have a definition in our administrative rules of what is a discretionary approval for the purposes of the environmental rules, and that's the best.
If I could go back just a moment, isn't your position, I'm just trying to put this in a nutshell, one of statutory construction? You know, you referred to NEPA, and you say NEPA has different language, and so changes in the circumstances surrounding a project may trigger the supplemental EIS, but that's not what's before us. I mean, according to your position, the statute and the regs, the only reading is this. There must be a significant change in the project. Maybe there should be a different policy, could be a different policy, but that's not what we have before us. Isn't that your position?
That is my position, and in fact, my understanding is that a relook at the rules is currently underway. The other factor that hasn't been discussed here is statute of limitations. And the issues that are being brought up by the appellants are not new or different circumstances. First of all, there's no statute of limitations equivalent in the administrative rules for supplemental EIS. It just doesn't exist. The only thing that exists would be Section 343-7 relating to the EIS process in general.
How do you trigger statute of limitations when an agency doesn't act? I can see when an agency acts that you've got a time limit to time period to trigger, but when they don't act, how do you?
We trigger it by actual knowledge. And here we have people who are complaining that the project's moving forward. When this project was affirmed by ordinance in the 1999 Ko'olaloa Sustainable Communities Plan, which is a very public process, it's one that's being undergone right now for revision, that was 1999. That wasn't 1985. And then again in 2001, City Council meeting, Zoning Committee, Kuilima was brought forward and said, being told, when are you going to move forward? What's going on? These are public processes. So
that's more of a laches argument than a statute of limitations claim, right?
Well,
it's hard. Usually the statute of limitations, you can define a specific event that starts the statute running. But I mean, you're giving us different situations. It's hard to say what the rule is that would say the statute began running at a particular point.
That may be fair, but here what we have are very specific issues that they're claiming, which is, all of a sudden, they're saying the project's moving forward. But this was the Ko'olaloa Sustainable Communities Plan was a very public process. And just as significantly, the issues that they're bringing up, traffic and species, those are not recent issues. And the EIS statute has very short time frames. And those very short time frames comport with a purpose of the environmental rules is not only environment alone, but it's to integrate the environmental considerations into the planning process to make informed decisions, allow the city or the state, whatever agency is under considering an issue at the time, to make an informed decision.
The plaintiffs also brought this under the declaratory judgment statute, though. What's the statute for that, or statute of limitations for that?
I think we'd have the same issue because the declaratory judgment statute would have to have an underlying basis for the claim. It needs to have an underlying basis, and the basis is that they're saying that the city did not comply, and by extension, the developer did not comply with the environmental laws. And so it makes no sense to say they could wait until the very last moment, after all of this time and money has been put into this project, and say, wait a second, even though we've known this information for 5, 10, 15 years, we're going to raise it now and say, you know what, you guys didn't go through the process that we think you should have gone through, and then thereby try to stop the project. And I posit that that's what we have here.
What's the value of all these conditions that the city imposed as part of the unilateral agreement?
This project, when it was conceived, was vetted very heavily. And, Your Honor, you're correct. It was post the shutdown of the sugar mill, etc. And there were a group of people, a large community group up in Kahuku, who were concerned and very, not as vocal, but still concerned about jobs. And those issues are coming back today with the economy we're about to go into based on a lot of people's predictions. And so what happened is there was a community back and forth. And there were meetings I believe they were monthly. It went on for like 2 years. And the result of that was the unilateral agreement. The unilateral agreement here was either the first or one of the first that was done in Honolulu. And it was seen as a big victory for the community. It provides mandates for parks. It's part of the plan. It provides for jobs. The people were concerned, and like I say, some are still concerned about having a sustainable community. The project itself was to provide low-income housing. There's going to be job assistance, job fairs. Part of the conditions, considered traffic, requires shuttling of employees, requires provision of vans and buses, what have you, for example, Polynesian Cultural Center in various places. So it was seen as a very big victory, and it provides a lot of community benefits to the community.
It isn't the thing that makes, I mean, the reason we're here is obviously because of the timeline. I mean, if this was done in the 10 years that the project, when initially approved, was contemplated would take, we really wouldn't be here. How does that factor in? Is Kuilima's position that in this case time is irrelevant, so that instead of 20 years, if the project was delayed for 40 years, you'd have the same arguments and we'd be in the same situation? So there's no outside time limit by which a supplemental impact statement could be required if the project itself didn't change?
Right. I actually think that's a valid topic for discussion. And it has been underway in discussion in the administrative rules relook in 1996 about whether there should be a shelf life on environmental impact statements. It was rejected. It's being looked at again on whether there should be a shelf life on environmental impact statements. But here there was no shelf life on an environmental impact statement. And more importantly, this is not a project, as the appellants would have you believe, that just sat for 20 years. The lower court found that from the time of the final entitlements that would allow us to move forward, things were happening. And the lower court specifically found in her findings of fact that there were a lot of things, and they are listed in the papers, and I have a listing of them here, that have been moving forward. And so while that may be a valid issue and concern, this isn't the case or the project in order to say it's been too long, because this process has been moving forward. There was a period during the mid-1990s where there was the severe economic downturn, of which I think we're all aware, where this project ran into some trouble. My clients came in and bought it. It was 98 or 99, I believe 98. And they have been moving the process forward. And at the very beginning, this process was moved forward. And but for a several-year gap in the mid-1990s because of the economic decline, this project has moved forward. I think that's an important thing to keep in mind when the appellants continue to say, this is a unique project, it's 20 years. Well, there are other projects on this island that have 20-year EISs. They may be farther along, but they're not completed with their development. So the decision here can have a far and long lasting impact on not only the Kuilima development, but a lot of developments. And based on the facts we have here, I just don't think implying a time limit where one doesn't exist is that this isn't the right case to do that.
Could, in the right case, a court imply a time limit if the statute and the regs don't address it?
I would say only if the court were to find that there is a reasonable interpretation that would allow them to do that, because I think that would be legislating a time limit into these rules and statute and regulations where one doesn't exist. The burden of proof motion decided things on the merits. And the court went through a fairly detailed analysis in considering both Kuilima's motion, to which the city joined, and as well as the appellant's motion, which she denied. And she found that The statute requires a change in the project, that the change, and this is just plain wording of the regulation. This is just the plain wording of the rule, that the change in the project has to be so substantial that it is essentially a new and different action under consideration. And that is what would be required in order for it to not be ultra vires of the Chapter 343 scheme. What she found, too, was that even if you were to assume that there had been a change, she looked at the evidence presented of cumulative impacts and changes that the appellants now say would mandate, that the appellants now say that a reasonable agency could not find other than the need for a supplemental EIS. The court found that she didn't find them significant enough to require a supplemental EIS.
But it's clear from the record that the agency itself did not consider whether circumstances surrounding the project could require an SEIS, right? Because their analysis was, did the project change? Answer no, stop looking at it.
In terms of the supplemental impact statement context, they didn't make that determination, but all of those issues.
Okay, but it isn't, assuming we disagree with your interpretation of the regulations and we find that changes in circumstances surrounding the project could potentially trigger the need for an SEIS. Isn't the evaluation of whether those circumstances are sufficient something that the agency itself, in the first instance, is supposed to look at?
Yes.
All right. So don't we have to send it, if we go that route, don't we have to send it back to the agency to make that first hard look?
I think that's right, because otherwise the court would be supplanting the agency's discretionary decision with its own. But here we have issues of what is new and what is different. Traffic was brought up. There's the EIS predicted terrible traffic. It absolutely said that traffic is going to be bad. And it said that traffic will be okay, but still bad, if there is an improved two-lane road along the shoreline, the Kamehameha Road. There's nothing new or different about traffic that wasn't considered and predicted in the EIS. And to address your question...
But the EIS traffic projection ended at 2000, right?
It ended at 2000. However, it's not significantly different than what we have today. And the DPP has required... I think we have six updated traffic reports. And I think when Mr. Kitaoka was saying it was evaluating the current conditions, it's current conditions projected forward. These are analyses that don't just say, what's the snapshot today? These traffic analyses, and they're in the record, project forward what's anticipated. And requirements are being put on Kuilima in the context of the subdivision to address those issues in connection with, for example, intersections and signaling, as well as the internal to the project, but internal to the project is kind of a different issue. And so those issues have been considered, and they are being considered, but most importantly for this particular analysis, they're not new or different. The other issue that's been brought...
So a traffic engineering study is one of the checklists of the subdivision approval?
If one is requested, once the DPP puts out the application to not only its own traffic department, but to the DOT, yes, and it has been for this project. And those have been requested to be updated several times, and that's happened. The other new evidence that's been brought up is species. One of them's sea turtles. This project's called Turtle Bay. I don't think anybody can validly say that turtles were not an issue when the EIS was undertaken.
And the monk seal?
The monk seals also, although they're not, I will admit they are not specifically identified in the EIS, but the monk seal was an identified endangered species. There is evidence in the deposition testimony in the record that monk seals were periodically seen up and down the North Shore by the appellants, some of the individuals from the appellants themselves. And the evidence in the record shows that In the Hawaiian Islands, the monk seals have been known, and they're an endangered species. And more importantly, maybe not more importantly, but importantly, the Kuilima area is not a critical habitat designated for monk seals. But what they're doing is they're challenging the sufficiency of the original EIS. And it's just too late. It's because these aren't new and changed circumstances. They say in their moving papers that, I'm sorry, in their briefing papers that these things should have been considered more thoroughly. There's a statute of limitations in 343-7 that gives a time period. The Sierra Club is one of the entities that commented on the EIS. So these aren't new or different circumstances here. And so we don't have the circumstance where there's been a hurricane that comes in and wipes things out. That's not the case we have here.
But under your position, it wouldn't make a difference if the hurricane came in.
Under our rules, for the purposes of an EIS, but again, the review process inherently considers the environmental conditions, the change in circumstance, because they're always looking at today what the status is.
Just for context, sure. Is the subdivision on the Makai side of Cam Highway? Or
yes.
The Maka side?
The Makai side.
The Makai side.
And I can't say that with 100% certainty. It might include some of the Mauka lands, but I believe it's just the Makai lands. So just in concluding, Your Honors, I think it's clear that it's not the environment at all cost. And Kuilima is serious about its environmental obligations. I don't think there's been any issue taken with how the monk seal on the beach was handled by Kuilima. In fact, I think they were praised for doing such a good job. And so they're not trying to ignore or belittle environmental concerns, but there has to be a balance. And there has to be a balance read in the context of the administrative rules that we have and the entire HEPA framework of Chapter 343. And in order to take this subdivision application and essentially say that it is something new and different, turns the plain language of those laws and rules on their head. And it would require the court to ignore several provisions of the regulations in order to reach the result that the appellants are requiring. And additionally, the other thing to consider, again, in this whole framework is, what is the purpose? The purpose is to inform decision-making. And here the decision-making has to do with the particular subdivision and how it lays out. And to the extent there is discretion, that discretion is limited to imposing conditions. And conditions here were imposed when the tentative subdivision approval was granted. So with all of that, Your Honors, we urge you to affirm the lower court's rulings and to deny the appellant's position. Thank you.
North Shore and Sierra Club are going to respond to 3 points. The first point is, hard facts establish DPP did not take a hard look, and they never take a hard look. They have a practice at not looking at new circumstances or evidence. The testimony is clear that they did not consider it. They put their head in the sand. They put the blinders on. And one of the most troubling things about this case is that they have a history of not doing it. There were 3 employees deposed. Their testimony is quoted verbatim to you. They could recall, each of them worked the DPP for approximately 17, 18 years. One, the land use chief, recalled one supplemental EIS being prepared in the whole years he'd been there.
Is there any evidence in the record that the project has changed? Not the circumstances, okay, but the project.
The implementation of the project has changed. The timing of the project has clearly changed. There was not a rigid time schedule imposed on the project. But in any project, there must be a rule of reason, that it must be reasonably implemented. It's 23 years later. They have constructed a total of 9 new units. They have not constructed 3,504 units. For them, for the resort owner and the city to say that the resort owner has perpetuity to complete this project and not be subject to environmental review, that turns HEPA on its head.
So what are we to read into HEPA as far as a time frame for a project? What's the standard? What's the language? Reasonable?
I believe so. I think all law is reasonable.
Implicit in any EIS is that it must be, the project must be completed within a reasonable period of time?
We actually really don't have to address that point in this case, because the time delay, this refusal to go through with the project in 23 years, did occur. And during that period of time, the surrounding circumstances, the new circumstances, it did change. That really is what causes this project that was...
Then the change in circumstances, not the time, is the issue.
I find them interrelated.
Time without a change in circumstances wouldn't make a difference.
It probably would not. Unless, of course, either side must result in some different or likely increased environmental impact that wasn't discussed in the environmental impact statement, which is exactly what we have here. Adding 5 giant hotels, a new visitor population, common sense tells us that that will increase these conditions of traffic gridlock, that there will be interaction with these protected species. These have never been studied in a HEPA document. That's all we're asking for. The second point I wanted to respond to was the city and county of Honolulu's doomsday argument, that if this court were to order the resort owner to prepare a supplemental environmental impact statement, it will result in, if I quote it, gridlock in the land use approval process. That is not correct. The legislature has already dealt with that issue. The legislature specified that only at certain times during the land use approval process will CEQA be triggered. That is only when an applicant requests one of these discretionary land use approvals. That is in there to prevent gridlock, and it is in there to provide a protection for the resort owner, to give that resort owner certainty that it is only at certain stages he or she or it is going to be subject to the HEPA process.
How many stages in this case would you say there were?
There have certainly been 3 major stages. There's been the environmental impact stage, there's been the agreement that we've talked about stage, and there is this stage. This stage is perhaps the last final discretionary land use approval process. This is probably the last opportunity that anyone could request that there be a reevaluation of the impacts of the project based on this changed circumstances. But because the legislature did address that, they clearly say that HEPA only applies when you seek a discretionary and non-ministerial thing. That's a protection. That gives the resort owner some certainty that their project will be able to go forward. This resort owner chose not to take advantage of that certainty. They delayed this. It's now 22 years. Their position is they have perpetuity to do this project. They can never be subject to supplemental environmental review. That is absurd. The final point I wanted to talk about was what this case is. I said at the outset, it dealt with changed circumstances, times have changed, HEPA processes and procedures, and public participation and informed decision-making. The city's representative has informed us that they continue to do work to this day. They assured the court they're doing this work. It's not being done publicly. The public is not being given an opportunity to participate in this process. The public does not know what is the information they're relying on to, for example, tentatively approve Kualima Resort Company's project, their resort expansion project. The fundamental core purpose of HEPA, what the legislature intended, what the Supreme Court tells us, is to enhance public participation in the process. This, Your Honors, this may be the last chance the public may be able to participate. This is a case about public participation and informed decision making.
Participating outside of this courtroom very actively?
Yes, they are. Indeed, they are. They are involved at every stage. It's outside of our record, of course. There is tremendous community sentiment about this. I'm not to talk. This is one venue. It is my privilege to be here. I thank you very much. Thank you. Please reverse the judgment.
Thank you. We'll take this matter under advisement.